Neon Dreams with Majosi, and then this from Bruno Mars, Locked Out of Heaven. It's the Stateside Connection, and we're mixing things up for a few weeks, not broadcasting from Texas to Joburg, but from Joburg to Joburg, and adding a bit of international flavor to it. Our guest on the Stateside Connection this week is a retired aerospace engineer who had very humble beginnings in the Free State back in the 60s and massive dreams of working for NASA one day. He is now retired and living in Canada, but joining me on the show this afternoon is a gentleman called Cobus de Villiers, who has led a remarkable life, and I'm so excited to share some of his life story with you. This is part one of my interview with Cobus.
From Dallas to Joburg, it's Cooler on 919.
Joining us this afternoon on 919 is a man whose bio reads like a spy novel, and I've been so intrigued about his life, and I'm so excited to have him join us on the show. His name is Cobus de Villiers, and he was born in the Free State in Bloemfontein in the 60s and went on to live this remarkable life that saw him living in various countries throughout the course of his career, and culminating in retiring in a beautiful part of Canada with a French wife who's from the French Riviera. It really does read like some kind of fairy tale novel. So Cobus, welcome to 919.
Thank you.
Take us back to your childhood in the Free State. Your bio mentioned that you had these ideas of one day designing and building rockets and fast aircraft, but that was a particularly foreign idea to your family and to your friends around you. Where did you get that passion inside you? Where do you think that came from, that you had these massive dreams that were so outside of the realm of ordinary in the Free State?
Some people thought I'm a bit dilly. Maybe I am. Anyway, I was born in Bloemfontein, and a few years later, my brother was born, and he had a bit of health problems. So I ended up living with my grandparents on the farm before I went to school for some time. And then that was the time when the Russians launched the Sputnik satellite. And of course, it became news. And my grandfather, who was actually a frustrated engineer, but he had to farm, we were lying on the lawn in front of the house on the farm, looking up in the sky, and we could see this little green dot flying over it. And he was explaining to me how this thing works and why it's up there. Mm-hmm. And from that time onwards, I was convinced this is what I want to do. I want to build stuff that can fly there, and I want to build stuff that people can go to other planets. And that it just got stuck in my head, and that's what I wanted to do. Now, coming from a Free State farm family, that was a bit of a crazy idea. I mean, everybody thought I should either become a doctor, because my father was a pathologist,
okay,
or a dominee, or a teacher. So becoming an engineer building spacecraft was really an alien idea.
A lot of the initial projects that you'd worked on were top secret, that you couldn't share with your family when you started your work career. How much of that are you able to share with us now?
Okay, as I said, nobody agreed with what I wanted to do. So my father had the attitude, if you want to do something crazy like that, I'm not going to pay for your studies. So I worked in the mines in Velkom, in the Western Holdings number 3 shaft, to get money to pay for my studies. And after my military training, I went to the University of Pretoria and I studied mechanical engineering. Of course, it's difficult if you don't have any financial backing. So I ended up applying for a bursary with SAA, which was the nearest to aeroplanes. And I got the bursary, and I started working for SAA when I graduated. And lucky for me, right at that time, Arms Corps decided to get Atlas Aircraft Corporation going. And they went to the universities and they looked at people's results. And they recruited people from other places. And I ended up being offered a job at Atlas Aircraft Corporation. And that's how I got into the aircraft design and development business. Atlas must have had some faith in me, because they sent me to Italy,
okay,
to work at Aeromachi, which was the company that we built under license, the Atlas Impala aircraft, and also the Kudu. So I got involved with the Kudu's design while in Italy. And then they sent me to university in Italy, which in the summer, the Aeronautical School of Milan does English classes, mainly with American teachers, which is ironical because of the boycotts. I couldn't go to an American university. I could study in Italy under an American teacher. So that's how the jobs started. Then from then onwards, because the boycott started biting, 78, 79 onwards, I first got sent on short-term jobs, 6 weeks and 3 months in Europe mainly, at companies that were still finishing off contracts that they agreed with South Africa. So, and I was sent back to Italy to work there again for a while. Mm-hmm. I worked in France, in Switzerland, and then I was sent to Israel for 5 years. And that's where I learned a hell of a lot. And we lived in Israel for 5 years, and I worked on several projects there. Some which I've mentioned in my books that I've written since I've retired. Some which I still can't talk about because you don't want to get involved with embarrassing people that were friendly to us in those days.
Well, that's remarkable. And how did you, you know, in terms of continuing relationship with your family back in South Africa, this was pre-internet days. I mean, you're living overseas for extended periods of time, years at a time. And then you can't tell them everything that you were working on. Was that a challenging time for you and your family, or did they embrace what you were doing and try and support you as best as they understood?
No, I was married at the time I was sent to Israel, and my wife and the two small kids went with me. But it did create a lot of problems with her parents and my parents because we weren't allowed to tell them where we were.
Oh, boy.
We had a P.O. box address in Pretoria, which they could send mail to, and a phone number in Pretoria they could call in terms of if there's an emergency in the family. So for a long time, my parents thought I'm just some little clerk at Arms Corps doing some 8-to-5 gray job. And unfortunately, my father passed away before I could tell him any of the stuff that I had achieved.
That must have been heartbreaking, because I'm sure you did want to share so much of that with him.
Yes, especially since everybody thought I was nuts and I wouldn't achieve what I did.
Yes.
But yeah, that's life, you know.
Well, what were some of the highlights for you in your career?
Okay, the first thing, of course, was the initial training in Aeromacchi in Italy and the studying in Italy. That kind of gave me the technical and the academic weapons to take on what I wanted to do. In Israel, I worked originally on a project which is still classified till today. But the second project I was exposed to was to develop Cheetah R2Z, which was basically a spy plane. And I was trained and I learned all the technical stuff. And then I came back to South Africa in 1985, 86. And I had a team of people at Atlas and we developed this aircraft. In 1987, it flew very successfully. But that was the first time that I had a huge project completely under my control with a huge budget. In those days, I think it was 35 million rand when the rand was still a dot.
Yes, that's remarkable.
And I was 33 years old, and I think I just had way more chutzpah than brains.
You must have wanted to pinch yourself a few times, I'm sure. It must have felt like you were dreaming.
Well, you know, it would oscillate between total fear, terror, and being extremely proud of myself.
Right.
And the frustrating thing was when people asked me at a braai or something, where do you work or what do you do? You know, I tell them, I clean the offices at Atlas Aircraft Corporation.
Oh, boy. And meanwhile, you're sitting on this massive secret.
Exactly. And that's why when I eventually retired, and some of these things, the statute of limits have expired, my wife, which my French wife, which is my second wife, she encouraged me and said, you know, you need to write this stuff down because the kids are not interested when they are teenagers. But everybody's going to want to know where you were, why we were there, why did we live in these strange places, why did we move around? Mm-hmm. So I made a bunch of essays of different projects and different events, mainly the funny stuff that happened because, you know, you Free State Plaza hoppy, ending up in the middle of Paris with no luggage and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And eventually she said we should compile this into a book, and that's how my first book was launched.
So you have five books that you have released now.
Yes.
So Top Secret was the first one, and that was available in English and Afrikaans. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Eiters Geheim was written first in 2018, and it sold so well, and I had an endless amount of requests for having an English version.
Okay.
So I translated it into English, and my wife, being a linguist, she can speak several languages. She helped with the editing and proofreading, and we launched it in the English version as well.
Wonderful. And these books are available through Amazon as well as Malherbe in South Africa. Your
yes.
second book was about life in Africa.
Yes.
And was that as a result of foreigners that you'd met through staying in different countries just asking you about life here?
Yes. You know, as any South African and you yourself will know that when you live in a foreign country, people have weird ideas about elephants in the street and lions in the garden and stuff like that. And you know, I married a French girl. We don't speak Afrikaans at home. We've lived in very strange places and eventually retired in Canada. So there's still the nostalgia about where you were born and where you grew up. And I got more and more people asking me, what was it like growing up as a kid in Africa? And there was a time when I was thinking, you know, it would be nice to kind of think back of my childhood and all of that. And of course, the time that I served in the military as a national conscript. So I started writing Once Upon a Time I Lived in Africa. And it's actually turned out to be the bestseller of the lot.
Well, I can see, yeah, there would definitely be international appeal for that. My Afrikaans is shocking. I understand it, but I feel so silly when I say Afrikaans words, but I'm going to just go all in here. Tell us about Vlug 437, Ben-Gurion na Waterkloof.
Okay, so that was the one project that I was working on in Israel. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that I cannot actually explain what exactly we did. But there are a lot of people who were linked to these projects and who eventually flew these aircraft or worked as mechanics on these airplanes who kept on egging me on, you need to write something. How did this come about? What did you do? So I ended up writing this book, which I call Faction. It's fact and fiction mixed.
Okay.
A lot of fact in there and some fiction. And it basically explains what it was like to be an engineer working undercover in a strange country, in which I really enjoyed. I learned to speak some of the language. I loved the people's culture. And of course, it's a very, very interesting part of the world.
Yeah.
I traveled around a lot in the Middle East while I was there. And this book basically runs from how did we get there? How did we work? How did we get these aircraft back to South Africa? And mixed with that is some of my personal experiences, being entertained at a sheikh's villa, tent town out at an oasis and things like that.
Well, that's part one of my interview with this week's guest on the Stateside Connection. His name is Cobus de Villiers, a retired aerospace engineer. In the next hour of the show, we'll be finding out how Cobus went on to achieve his dream, his lifelong goal of working for NASA. Back to the music now on 919 with Bon Jovi and Living on a Prayer.